I need a playlist. There's no music playing in the background, and I need a series of songs. Songs that will provide me with existential assistance so that I can find something to fill in my empty life. It's such a void, or so you think. It's nothing without music, or so you think. I mean, you're probably listening right now, and you're probably just as disturbed as I am about the fact that there isn't a single piece of background music or any kind of snippet or any kind of song playing to drown out my voice. And if you are disturbed, it's probably because you're listening to this waiting to hear the far more interesting component of this podcast, which is Arthur Phillips, the novelist. We'll get to him eventually, but you're not interested in me. I mean, I haven't written a book, and you don't even know if I'm Bat Segundo, Ed Champion, or any number of possible characters who fill in the time, who fill in the void before one of these shows. Perhaps I should go on. Perhaps I need to disturb you. Perhaps I need to inform you that, yes, a good deal of time goes into these silly podcasts, and none of you really care. You might wish me to puff away and die, as the protagonist for Nicholson Baker's forthcoming novel has suggested of podcasters. And of course, it could all go away tomorrow, and perhaps some of you might miss it. But I'm guessing, not really. Program directors have told me that I'm too smart for their stations, so what really is the point of doing this? Well, I guess it's because there's nobody else quite doing this, and after all, someone has to represent this side of the spectrum. Even if it isn't entirely commercial, or particularly enticing, or particularly entertaining, or one of those things that can fit into a neat niche or demographic, but it is something that you're simply not going to hear on the radio. But is such an assumption egotistic, solipsistic, narcissistic? One could argue the same about writing. One could argue the same thing about anything, really. Arthur Phillips, however, is a good egg who understands these subjects, these dilemmas, and considerably more. Listen to the interview.
Okay, so I'm here with Arthur Phillips, who is the author most recently of The Song Is You. Arthur, how are you doing?
Very well, Ed. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. It's a pleasure to finally speak with you. This is going to be an impromptu kind of thing because I raced here to get here, but I'm sure we will manage. I must first ask about just the sheer thematic notion of your book here. You have a situation in which you have characters who are almost enslaved to culture and to music over life itself. In fact, we have this prologue at the very beginning in which we see Julian's father very much remembering and holding on to this Billie Holiday moment. So it's very much in the DNA of this family, as we see with Julian and also with Aiden, who is this essentially this Jeopardy champion and this fact hoarder. I'm curious why you needed to dwell so much on characters who valued like simply pack ratting facts like this or culture like this over the course of life. I mean, is it a position that you're trying to convey to the reader that this is a possible danger? Is it simply a kind of alternative that you're trying to present? Or are you, in fact, possibly challenging your literary audience by saying maybe you might want to be shaken up out of your obsession with culture? What of this, Mr. Phillips?
Oh, boy. Is there a none of the above option? Can I take none of the above?
You can't take none of the above.
I'm going to take none of the above. I am someone who has in my time hoarded facts and is very fond of my culture and my library and my music collection and my favorite movies and all the rest of it. I do think that stuff is among the most important stuff in my life. Not at the expense of so-called humans, but it certainly matters a lot to me in the same way that sports matters maybe more to some people or knitting to others. So I don't present it as either an alternative or a danger or an argument or a position. I just, I'm on the side of, imagination and storytelling, I guess,
yeah.
Since we were just talking about that. And, I don't think I've ever had a position about anything, and I hope never to take one.
Well, so. I mention it to be either a position or a theme simply because you do have Kate's apartment. You have this scene where we see this painted mirror of life.
Right.
That this this moment from the past was essentially frozen into shape by paint. So it seems very much, I would argue, a dialectic between art and life. And so I would suggest that you are, in some sense, taking a position. The question becomes how aware you were of it, because you did have two and a half years to dwell on it.
You may be a better reader than I am a writer. To me, compositionally, it's and thematically, it tends to feel a lot more like that feels right just at that moment, and that image feels right, and that there's a sense of piecing resonances together. And so at the end of it, yeah, I can't really argue with you, I guess, that there is this recurring motif of people either frozen in their culture or the culture frozen in the case of this painted mirror that seems to carry in it some sort of larger argument. I just have to continually deny that I have a larger argument. And even when we talk about it now, it's only real and important within the realm of those pages.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Well, to what extent would you say the theme is important, or do you just essentially not even concern yourself with theme?
Well, I guess the theme is one of those words that I've had a hard time understanding since, you know, third grade, and you had to fill out a book report, and then it got to the bottom, and it's, what is the theme? And your choices were man versus nature and man versus man, I think, were the two possibilities. The term came up again. I remember reading Nabokov's lectures on literature, and he says theme or motif, I think interchangeably, is in his position, sort of a recurrent image or idea that is not necessarily an argument or what we would call an argument, I suppose, what the ancients would call a debate or a proposition. So I do have to come back and say I don't really know what theme means.
Yeah.
I don't think I hang my stuff on anything other than an aesthetic feeling and an aesthetic concern, and that those are driven by themselves. They're perpetual motion machines. You know, you come up with a character, the character's interests are here, therefore that character is going to go into these situations and meet these other sort of people connected by these threads, and these threads then, at the end of it, look a little bit like maybe I was up to something. But I think I'm going to deny that I was up to something.
Well, but you were aware of aesthetic concerns, and I should also point out that by having a male muse in this, you are essentially playing against reader expectations, because we frequently associate a muse with a woman.
Right.
And it's a very interesting playing against the reader's expectations, but nevertheless, I'm interested in how aware you are or how planned you are in terms of just wanting to invert formulas like this.
Well, that, I think, is something else. Inversion of formulas, I think, is... I might even confess to having on my mind from time to time, both early in the process, but more often sort of in the middle of it. Because a very common... I mean, I'm not, you know, handing out MFAs or anything, but it's a pretty easy thing to help yourself by saying, what would normally happen here? What are the first 10 things I can think of happening here? And then if I throw those away, now what can I think of? And, you know, you're likely in the 11th or 12th time around maybe to come up with something that you haven't seen before. Your first reflexes tend to be, I've read that, I've seen that, I've heard that, I've whatever. So if you keep, or you say, what's the most obvious thing that can happen? Now, what's the absolute opposite of that? Let's work with that for a while. And maybe you throw it away the next day.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think the inversion of expectation, inversion of forms is much on my mind when I'm working.
But actually, I want to see if we can tie in the inversion of expectations with your own particular experience, because here you have your first contemporary novel set in America.
Right.
And you've chosen a location that is very close to you, Brooklyn,
right,
over Los Angeles, which is the usual center of the music industry.
Right.
Likewise, you have this character, Aiden, who is the worst-case scenario of the Jeopardy champion.
Right.
I might argue that this book was possibly the most personal for you by being closer to you and by having these particular qualities. So how does this tie in with playing against readers' expectations? Why this familiar terrain for this particular book, for this more contemporary, I suppose, book? I mean, Prague, of course, was contemporary, but, you know...
Well, to a certain extent, I guess that early on in the decision, it was, you know, here are the things that actually matter to me. This character, Kate, actually, writing about music, writing about time passing and clinging to culture as a way of holding on to your past. So those things were on my mind. It didn't much matter to me where I put it. I never had a reason, as I have had in some other books, to say it's got to be here or there. And so I've never spent much time in LA. I don't have any feel for it. I saw no reason not to put it right here, within a few blocks of where we're sitting.
Yeah.
Now, yeah, so the worst thing that possibly could happen to a Jeopardy guy happens to a Jeopardy guy. It's set around here. it is a personal book, I guess, but it's not autobiographical, and so, and I don't think that I drew on anything more of my own than I have in previous books, although people will find that probably puzzling, considering they were Victorian or Egyptological. I just happen to live here.
Yeah.
So, to me, all the books are personal. They're all equally personal. They're all very personal. And yet, they're not at all, I wouldn't think, easily revelatory of autobiography.
Yeah.
And I don't think this one's any different, really.
Well, this raises a very interesting notion of taking a very concrete personal detail, like
right.
you being a Jeopardy champion,
right.
and placing it into a book, whether that is perhaps either more or less personal than
right.
essentially a feeling that
right.
you're putting in, say, the Victorian era,
right.
or the Egyptologist, or
right.
whatnot. So, what to you would be the most personal feeling? A specific detail or a specific, I suppose, visceral attachment here?
Probably visceral. I mean, the Jeopardy stuff, I've been on Jeopardy. I know how it works, and the thought of what's the worst thing that could happen to me had crossed my mind at some point. And so dramatizing that for somebody else was related to my personal history, but certainly it didn't, you know, it doesn't feel like tugging at my heartstrings exactly. You know, the most personal thing in the book, the most specifically mine experience thing in the book is the process of listening to headphones all the time. I mean, I do.
I saw that.
And I have for as long as that character has, and I have my feelings for headphone music are as, I mean, I just, there are many things I can put in a fictional character and say, I haven't felt it, but I could imagine feeling it. And that's what I usually do. But in the case of the relationship to headphones, what I have felt is what I put in this character.
Yeah.
And so I feel very attached to my headphones and feel very strongly that they have defined my life. And I'm not going to say for good or for bad, but for both, like everything else. Like apples have defined my life for good and for bad. Sometimes they're tasty and other times they give me a stomachache. But they're an aesthetic part of my life.
Sure.
So that's probably the most personal touch of the book that's really from my lived experience when I wasn't simultaneously writing.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but I say that kind of facetiously, but sort of true too, because the stuff that didn't happen to me, which is the majority of what I write, the stuff I haven't felt, which is the majority of what I write, the act of writing it down or thinking about it and then writing it down is extremely personal to me and one of the great pleasures of my life. And so after a while, it all becomes very personal. I've never seen a ghost, but the experience of the character in the last book who sees a ghost is very personal to me.
Yeah.
I don't know if that really answers your question. I mean, maybe all I'm saying is that I'm a writer, but...
It does, but it also brings to mind a question of this what-if possibility,
mm-hmm.
where you're essentially extending some personal experience by
yeah.
posing either a ghost
right.
or a Jeopardy
right.
experience gone awry. And to what degree... This is a matter for you to, I mean, to what degree is writing a sort of way for you to expand upon your personal experiences or even transcend them by turning them into outright lies or things that never actually happened to you?
It's a big deal to me. I mean, it's part of the adventure of it. I can't do all the things in life I've imagined doing, and as I get older, I'll be able to do even fewer of them. Writing about people somewhat like me or not at all like me, or meeting people not at all like people I've actually met, feels like... I'm not going to say I'm delusional and say it feels like lived experience, but it, you know, I spend hours a day sitting there alone making stuff up.
Yeah.
That's not for everybody, but it brings me a lot of satisfaction. And, you know, you start, it comes out of 100 different sources. It comes out of fears, you know, I mean, somebody loses a child in this book. So I have children and I fear losing my children, like just about anybody else who has children, unless they get irritating, and then you sort of plan to lose them. But generally, you fear losing them. And so you write about what would it feel like if I lost them? What would it feel like if I was in a situation where I simply could not find a single bridge to communicate with my spouse? You know, that's certainly part of the last book. What would it feel like if I spent my life dedicated to something that was horseshit? That was something to do with the Egyptologist.
Yeah.
So those fears... are one of the many things that'll set you off on a certain path, or at least maybe not set you off on the path as much as the sort of thing you find as you're going. I mean, the things that start a book for me tend to be very small and very distant from what you would call personal. They tend to be more like
conceptual or
Well, they vary. An idea of a character of somebody I haven't met. Well, gee, what if I met somebody like that? Or what if I had done this, which I didn't do, to somebody else, and they had done this in response, which never happened, and then they went home. They're now far away from the me that didn't exist, and they did that. And then I think, oh, there's a good story. Way over there, seven derivations from here. Or, you know, I mean, the Egyptologist started with, I don't know where it came from, the image of the ending of that book, the last two pages of that book, which I'm very, very fond of. I don't know where it came from, but I thought, I got to write that book. Then you start gluing stuff on the side. It starts attracting, you know, burrs as you're walking down this path. Stuff sticks to you. Oh, look at that. That's actually the thing I fear most. Or look at that. That's something funny that never happened to me, but it would have been a good story.
Yeah.
It's a long, you know, you spend 2 or 3 years walking down this path that started apparently out of the blue, what we call inspiration. And by the time you get to the other end of it, you're covered in burrs.
Yeah.
Well, this also brings to mind bringing up the 2-year-old son who is dead. What's interesting about this male muse scenario is that Julian, he has to lose his wife, he has to lose his son in order to be a muse. Huh. And I'm curious why you had to create this vacant expanse for him to become this, you know, attached so much to Kate like that. It was just a matter of, like, taking again the formula and just inverting the gender? Or was it a matter of just, like, making him just so so in need of something to fill up that space?
You know, it's interesting. A reader, any particular reader, and you in this case, will see it and say, those are the things that led him to be able to be open to being a muse. And during the composition, it feels more like something's not right here. Let's poke it from this side and see what happens. That feels good. Let's move on now, and we'll come back to it at a later draft. And a lot of the larger questions, some of them get asked because I think of them too, and some of them I don't think of them. And so the question is, why did he have to be in this place to become a muse? I don't know that he did have to be, but I know that it didn't feel right until this particular set of circumstances was put in place. He would do the things he did. This particular imaginary guy would do the things that he did in the book based on the situation that he was in fictionally prior to that. So then we get to the end of it and we say, well, why did those things have to happen for him to do the things that he did? On the one hand, it's taking fiction appropriately seriously. On the other hand, it's almost too taking it too seriously in a way that I can't almost wrap my brain around it because he doesn't exist. I mean, I can come up with a kind of crap answer and say, well, for a man to be a muse, he has to be, you know, he has to be extracted from his manly pursuits.
Yeah.
But I don't know that that's true. I think, you know.
Well, that assumes a sort of gender attachment
to me. It does. And so, and I'm sure that women who actually do write songs about their boyfriends, relationships thing, you know, whatever, Alanis Morissette, I'm sure wrote songs about her boyfriends, one of whom, I guess, was this actor, Ryan Reynolds. So I'm sure that Ryan Reynolds, in fact, was a muse to Alanis Morissette. I don't know that he's lost anything particularly or is in any way sort of more accessible to musery than you are.
Yeah.
And I know people write songs about you. So I don't know that there's an answer here.
Well, one must also ask whether you have experienced or muse, or you have been a muse for other people. Personal experience?
No, I don't think I have no knowledge of ever having been a muse. I have been a male model for an artist friend of mine, pretty well clothed. And, you know, I did hang around both literal and figurative bohemia a lot when I was younger and enjoyed myself quite a bit there. And I enjoyed a world where it felt like, wow, everyone is making art. I thought that was great. And, you know, and so my friends would paint and I'd pose for their paintings, and then I was a musician at the time and I'd go off and make music and try to think about girls and try to turn them into muses in some way, and other friends were writing poems and people were writing poems about all of us living together making art, and you know, it was great fun.
Well, this also brings to mind another interesting question. If you have no explicit personal experience to draw from, how much do you need to invent in order to make it real? I mean, is the fact that a novel is essentially a, you know, a medium of lies,
right,
that this essentially does away with the notion of having to get everything just right, or do you think in a manner in which the details simply just continue to crop up and therefore create the illusion, the illusion itself takes on more life, that therefore personal experience really is not even a factor at all, or is it a factor?
I don't have an overarching theory of literature, and every time I have ever tried to have one, it falls apart if I compare it to writers that I like. So my overarching theory is that there isn't one, and that the great wonder of this stuff that we read is that it has as many theories as it has books and authors that you like. So in my own case, I generally have been under the impression that my personal experience is not that interesting and not that important, especially when compared to what I can make up. And I'm entirely on the side of write what you can write and write what you can imagine and write what you can feel at the end of it is imbued with some life. And, you know, life doesn't necessarily come from a shitty childhood. I managed to avoid one. I had a very nice childhood.
Yeah.
And yet I feel like I could write a shitty childhood if I had to. And I have written various forms of one. And I don't think there's anything to be gained by looking for me in my books, because what little there is of me is not, it's not easily related to me. It's what there is of me I put there. I make stuff up for a living. I really like to do that. I like to build these little fake houses. I don't know if that answers.
Well, it does.
I get a little confused.
I'm processing this because I'm actually curious about how this relates to the maxim, write what you know.
Yeah.
If what you know is essentially fake houses,
yeah,
or even aesthetic details, then what is it that you really know? Or is that just really, yeah, a matter of just constantly shuffling the genre or the emphasis or the details or the environment in your over the course of four
books?
Do
you mean specifically me? What do I know? Yeah, or what, is, yeah. what do I think the writer should know?
What do you know? What are you writing about what you know? Here we
I don't really believe in write what you know, for me anyhow. I totally believe in write what you can make up plausibly by your own standards. I know that a lot of people write what they know, and they write from experience, and they get their feeling of creation by seeing exactly how much of their lived life they can put in the book and change here or there, or just start to put in the illusion of lived life. I mean, the Roth books are playing with a very, very narrow window of what you can make up. What can you make up about a guy with my name? What can you make up about a guy with my name and my job and my history and my childhood in Newark? You know, that's he narrows that down into a very fine thread, but he's still making a lot of stuff up. And at the other end of the extreme, you know, you have the guys who place their stories on another planet with elves. Write what they know. Well, you know, they're far off from what they know, but they can do it. So in my own case, I'm sure I will finally... I wrote about a city that I lived in 10 years after I left it. I wrote about Brooklyn while I was living here. I wrote about Jeopardy 5 years after I was on, or 10 years after I was on. I'll get back to stuff that I have actually seen and actually done, I'm sure. But I don't think it's the best of it, and I don't think it's the most important part of it. I'm very interested when I realize I'm writing about a character, I think convincingly experiencing an emotion I haven't particularly had. I get very excited about that. So...
I'm curious, to what degree do you need distance from a location? You were alluding just in this last answer to having a number of years before you tackled something via fiction. And I'm curious, why in this case, for example, Brooklyn was such an immediate journey from experience to the page.
I don't know. I think because I think I finally decided that location really didn't much matter in this book. And that what I wanted to spend my imaginative efforts on were not recreating a place far away from me, either geographically or temporally. And I just I saw no reason not to stick it in New York, to stick it right outside the door here. It really could have been anywhere. It could be in Austin. It could be in Manchester. It could be in Minneapolis, where I grew up. It could be, I don't think it much mattered. And to the extent that there are descriptions of Brooklyn, because I wanted to set a scene and because I happen to like Brooklyn, you know, then it starts to feel more and more Brooklyn-y. You can't help it, because if you're going to describe, if you're going to say this is where we are, if you're not going to just say we are in the city of X, then you start to throw in a tree here and a street there and a dog run, and suddenly you're, it resembles Brooklyn. But functionally, it didn't have to be here, I don't think.
So it seems to me...
Although you're a better reader than I am, so you may realize why it had to be Brooklyn.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not you. I didn't actually write the book, so... But
Between the two of us, we'll sort this thing out.
But I must ask about this idea of the personal versus the artistic. It seems to me that you have a very clear wall that you have erected personally between the personal and the artistic.
Right.
And likewise, well, this is an issue with this particular book. I'm wondering, we're almost getting into Zizek territory with this.
Into which territory?
Oh, Zizek territory or Lacan, by this notion of what is real and what is imaginary and what is symbolic. But I'm curious about the wall that you erect between the personal and the artistic, and whether you feel that at this point in your career, there are possibly problems by having that wall erected, or do you feel pretty comfortable with how things are divided for you?
Well, I guess, I don't think it's a wall. It's just a habit and an inclination and a tendency. I'm prepared to write something more about my lived life, I guess, if such a thing were to occur that I thought it would make a good novel. So I don't think there's a wall. I just don't think it's going to make a good, very good book.
Yeah.
So I'm extremely comfortable. I'm very happy with all my books and happy with their relationship to what we commonly call reality. I lived in Budapest, and so a novel about Budapest, set at the time that I lived there, inspired a certain amount of chatter among people who lived there that so-and-so was based on somebody we all knew. And in almost no case was it ever true. And I sort of absorbed early on something Kundera had written about, don't let your books get turned into things that people talk about as if they're real, because it'll just, the book is going to die. And so I've always sort of had that warning in the back of my mind. If you can say such and such is the author, or such and such is the author's dad, or such and such is the guy the author worked for, then you're deflating this sort of magic souffle.
Yeah.
And, you know, souffle actually is a better word than wall for me. I puff up souffles, and I don't want them to get squished.
And yet, for the lack of rigidity in the characters, in the many possibilities of interpretation, there is still, nevertheless, a four-season structure to your novel.
Yeah.
So when does structure become necessary, and when must it become a... the territory of the souffle?
The souffles have structure. Otherwise, they wouldn't stand up like that and hold their air. So specifically, when was the chronology in place for the story, or when was the decision made to make it a year
to make it a year, four seasons kind of scenario?
Well, part of that was just functional, to keep time straight, to try to gauge, as you're writing a first and a second draft, certain things seem like they're going to require time. There's got to be a month between X and Y, or that's got to be the next day. And so you start to figure out how long your story is. And then, having figured it out relatively early on, you start to try to make it clear to somebody else how long this is taking on. And you can make that extremely explicit. You can have time entries at the top of every chapter that makes it very clear. You can make it very vague. It's very hard to tell how long a Shakespeare play is supposed to take. It's very hard to tell how long, In Search of Lost Time takes. Everyone's vaguely ageless forever. They're either adolescents or old men, and you can never quite tell when they went from one to the other. So for me, just purely aesthetically, this felt comfortable saying it's going to take a year, and this is how it's going to get divided up. And then you get into a sort of metaphorical, like, well, the seasons do seem to have some bearing on the main character's sort of emotional state and emotional development, sort of a very it bothers me a little bit, hackneyed kind of, he's thawing, he's hot, he's getting cold again. But, you know, seasons don't make any sense anymore anyhow, so it doesn't matter. Actually, you know what? I have to just
type
something here.
Sure.
I wrote it from, 2006 to 2008. It's set in 2009, so it was finished, early to middle last year. Spring is late in New York in 2009.
Yeah.
And sure enough, spring is late.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's fucking genius.
Simultaneously, though, if we're talking about time, there's also the notion of reader's time. Mm-hmm. And as a stylist, you have some control over how frequently or how long or how short the reader is going to turn the page.
Yeah.
When I read your book, I found numerous passages where I would slow down, and then when dialogue would bump up, particularly with the scenes with the cop,
right.
It then sped up.
Right.
And so I'm curious as to if time on a structural level was important, I'm curious if there was any importance you placed in terms of thinking of the reader and thinking of this notion of how fast and how slow the reader is going to turn the page along this.
That's such a great question. And on the one hand, I want to say, geez, I wish I had more conscious, and I will vow in the future to have more conscious understanding of those technical matters. On the other hand, it seems a little impossible to control. Well, not just a little, it's entirely impossible. I think anytime you start getting into what does the reader or what does a reader expect, react to, experience, you're doomed. I mean, it can't be. You have one or 10 or 100 or 10,000 or 100 million readers. They're just different. And this is just so obvious that it's not saying anything, but it says everything. Because if everybody's going to have a slightly different reaction, even just take the smaller subset of the people who quote-unquote like it, they're going to all have a different reaction. You can't plan for them. So the only reader that you can really have much planning for is yourself. And so at which point I don't really have to think very consciously about, I need to speed it up here, I need to slow it down here. All I have is the feeling of, I'm bored. And so when I'm writing, I go back and I read the draft, and I say, oh, this is just, I'm just bored. Something has to happen here that's different than what is happening, because I don't like it. And then at the end of it, when I've gone and done that 25 times, and I say, I like the whole thing, then it's done.
Well, to deflate my own interlocutory souffle, I should point out that it could just very well be the difference between having lots of dialogue and having lots of imagery. I guess the question here is how intuitive is it really? I mean, when you're getting lost in a long sentence, whether as a writer or even as a reader, you're going to be aware of the slowness, or maybe you're lost in such a fugue state that there really is no sense of time.
Right. I'm reading The Recognitions right now, and
first time. Oh wow.
And having all kinds of temporal feelings about that book as I work with it. There are times when I am lost in a fugue state, although not often enough for my taste. And often a feeling of, I think Gaddis was lost in a fugue state and I just can't join him for some reason. I don't know that it's just images versus dialogue. I think you can have some very impenetrable, hard to wrestle with dialogue. And actually that's what brings Recognitions to mind, because there are long passages of dialogue.
I know, yeah.
There's a 40-page party scene of almost nothing but dialogue. Yeah. And you have to go, well, wait a minute, who is this the same person who 4 pages earlier was talking, and where is that in relation to the little girl asking for sleeping pills and all the rest of it? So it goes on and on. So you can have some very slow moving dialogue. And actually I was thinking about Gaddis writing that in 55 and Nabokov in some period around the same time, doing one of his customary unappealing little digs at novels that are all dialogue, and thinking, I wonder if he'd read this, looked at it, had any feeling about this, would have included or excluded it from that grouping. Generally speaking, light dialogue goes faster than description or internal thought, but not necessarily, I guess, is the short answer. I could have said not necessarily about 15 minutes ago.
That's all
there
right.
There you go. Just cut it down to the dialogue. Yeah, not necessarily.
Yeah. But this doesn't quite answer the question of the intuitive notion of writing for you. You mentioned that you will change your prose if you feel that you're bored.
Yeah.
What is it really? Is it, do you take this question? Do you try to answer it on a sort of day-to-day level? It just depends on what you're feeling like, or is it a question of wanting to solve a particular problem that has surfaced? I mean, what degree is intuitive? To what degree is it a sort of a problem-solving scenario? Or am I really kind of overthinking your particular process?
No, you're not overthinking. That is exactly the process. But I just couldn't tell you how often one happens versus the other. You know, it's the great and wonderful feeling of adventure about writing is the same as the great and horrifying feeling about the chaos of writing. You write an outline one day and you follow it for a while, and then halfway through it you realize it doesn't apply anymore and you throw it away. And then you improvise for a while and then you realize you don't know what the hell to do next, and so you start to write outlines. And then you finish the draft and realize it's not just like four pieces in the wrong place. The whole thing's inside out. And you had a friend who realized, you know, pretty long into the process that he was going to throw away the first person, write the whole book in the third person, or the other way around. And it wasn't, you know, unfortunately not just a question of saying search, find, and replace all he with I.
Yeah.
It changed everything. So sometimes you're doing very intuitive work, and that feels intuitive. And other times you're doing very logical, practical, structural, problem-solving things. Somebody has to get from A to B. I am bored for these 10 pages. There's too much X, not enough Y. I don't understand her. I do understand him. There's too much, you know, and you balance things out until it feels intuitively workable again.
Well, this brings to mind the question of whether you have ever faced any dramatic reworking along these lines, that you have felt you have ever made a particular mistake in any of your novels, because they're all very stylistic in some sense. And I'm curious if you've ever had to essentially reinvent the wheel throughout any of the four novels.
A little tangential answer. A friend of mine who teaches an MFA program and I were discussing MFA programs, and he said once, what we really are doing in these things is making sure people don't have to reinvent the wheel. So that's what brings this to mind. And I remember thinking, but that's the whole point. Every time you sit down, your job is, grandly, reinvent the wheel. You know, find the thing that you haven't seen, at least in a while, that you haven't done before, that you feels fresh or new to you. So, but that, well, sort of, you know, grand and romantic sounding, comes down into daily work as a certain amount of head scratching and befuddlement. And so, to answer the question, in all the books, at some point or another, I have said, this isn't working at all. And original ideas have long since vanished, and my inspiration for being here in the first place is gone, and I don't remember what I'm doing or why I'm doing it. And the solutions to that, the short answer is the solution is you just go back and write some more. And the long answer is sometimes you throw away a lot of stuff and you're on the verge of rearranging the pieces and suddenly it locks into place again, temporarily or permanently. And sometimes that surgery is smaller and sometimes it's larger. I haven't had anything that to me feels catastrophically requiring a rework. I haven't thrown away, you know, a 300-page practically done thing because it sucks all of a sudden. But I've certainly had to change course 1,000 times along the way.
Yeah. But there's also the matter of changing course or even sticking to a particular structure that you set up in the first place, because writers change over the course of years. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if the changes, the little changes that you make along the way, are enough to, I suppose, keep the work organic and to keep the structure more or less intact, that that this accounts for your own particular development as a human being.
God, I feel like I'm in therapy. I think the books end up the way they end up because of the 10,000 decisions you make along the way that include, do I go back to the first principles I started with or do I throw them away? Which is a pretty recurrent question. I'm writing something now and I am deep enough into the first draft that I keep saying, like, why the hell am I doing this? What was I thinking about at the start of this process? And I seem to have lost track of it, and do I want to go back to it or not? Does that answer your question? I mean,
it does. Yeah, it does to some degree.
And also, the way I work, going from draft to draft, I have tried to make just technically as slow a process as possible, or not slow, laborious. I write first drafts longhand, which requires a couple of things. It requires going slower than I would go on a keyboard. It requires entering all that stuff back into a keyboard for the second draft, which is a slow process. And it requires a difficulty in finding previous passages that I have been. So by the time you've got, 300 pages of handwritten stuff, it's very hard to remember whether you have used a particular phrase, whether you have, where you left something 200 pages earlier. You know that it's temporary because it encourages jumping around and saying, I'll glue this back wherever it goes later. It encourages a fractured first draft. And I think that actually is good insurance against later catastrophes. And also, because it slows down the process of getting from first draft to second draft a lot, and the second draft is going to be significantly both longer and different from the first draft, you tend to make the decisions, I think. You have two or three chances to make long-standing, hard-to-break decisions, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does make sense. But simultaneously, I would also say that this would require a considerable amount of patience, and this would also require an absolute resilience towards sticking with something, because there is something likewise to be said for, I guess, the sense of urgency that a novel often comes out of. And I'm sure that you may have slowed down the process with this particular process, but simultaneously there have got to be some parts of you that are urgent that want to get the thing done. So what do you do to counter all this?
Well, urgency has an important role to play. It is a wonderful job when you think about all the stuff you have to keep balanced. But also, it's so wonderful because if you're feeling urgent, then you respond urgently to the urgent issues at hand. And if you're feeling methodical, then you have plenty of methodical stuff you could be doing too. I mean, you're really, let's stick with building a house. You're building this house. If there's rain pouring through the roof, that's the thing you got to deal with today. If it isn't, then you can work on, the upholstery. And the fact that you get to do both, that you're both roofer and upholsterer, is what makes it so wonderful. So, I have technical answers to what do I do with urgency. There's different notebooks, and there's different notebooks in different parts of the house, and different ones in my pocket, and ones in the work bag, and all the rest of it. So that urgency always has an outlet. And then that urgency, I hope, is contained in the words enough that by the time it gets filtered back into the main pile of words, it carries with it.
Yeah, but simultaneously, why should the writing process be so difficult?
Well, for all we've discussed today, I guess I would never use the word difficult particularly.
Complicated.
No, it's complicated because you're trying to transmit 2 years of thought and 300 pieces of paper. There's no reason that shouldn't be complicated. It's complicated. We do a complicated job. Writing an essay is complicated. Writing a review is complicated. So it's just the number of pages we're talking about that adds a certain amount of complexity to it. But difficulty particular suffering or horror, I don't really associate with my job.
So. Okay, fair enough. I must also ask if you have any particular aversion to the politics of dancing, because Reflex is the name of the group in this, and I was very curious because you have this aging musician, one former musician crop up, and the band's name is The Reflex, and I immediately thought, is Arthur here like a fan of the politics of dancing, which is run by The Reflex? Not to get like...
Wait, what is this?
I
have no idea.
The politics of dancing, the politics of you, feeling good.
The band was The Reflex?
Yeah. It was just like one hit wonder, and the name of the band is Reflex.
No.
Yes.
Oh God! I searched for.
It's dash flex. That's the name of the band.
That's why it didn't come up.
Yeah.
I searched for some of the bands and the music is real in the book, and some of it's fictional. And so when I was making this fictional band, I was like, well, I can't use anything that's been used. And so I had, it was Reflux for a while.
Yeah.
And but there was already a band called Reflux.
Yeah.
And so I was like, well, what about Reflux? And I didn't find anything.
Yeah, there's a Reflux.
Oh, no.
Politics of Dancer.
Oh, no. Send them a note saying, I'm sorry. I didn't mean them.
Yeah. It has some really ridiculous lyrics, too, like, the politicians are now DJs. And it's like one of those 80s songs. And so I was like,
I should have known that.
Yeah. I'm surprised that nobody at Random House picked this up.
What kind of fact-checking department is this? Well, they didn't notice that James Frey made up his book either.
Oh,
so
well, yeah,
what are you
going to
do?
Well, I mean, you know, going to the back to this question of music, to what degree was it important for you to invent fake songs? I mean, why did you have to have the percentage of real songs to fake songs
right.
that you had in this particular?
There is no importance to the percentage, I don't think. It was just, one reason is financial. It costs a lot of money to use lyrics of real songs.
Yeah.
So as I learned, you got to cut everything way down, and I had longer passages of real songs, and then I had to cut them away because people wanted thousands of dollars for me to quote their songs.
Wow.
The original epigraph to the first section was, you say you want a revolution, well, you know we all want to change the world. Nike ad, 1988.
Yeah.
A certain band's music publisher, I'd rather not say who, wanted, I think, $15,000 and wanted to remove the words Nike ad 1988 and replace it with the Beatles, Lennon and McCartney.
Wow.
Which would have pretty well defeated the purpose and also cost me $15,000.
For two lines?
Yeah.
They're that controlling.
You say you want a revolution, well, you know we all want to change the world. 16 words. And generally the lawyers have been saying 15 and under you can do for free. $15,000.
Well, the question is if you change, like, say, two of those words, so it was just different enough,
yeah.
maybe you can get away with it. I don't know. I'd say Nike at 1987.
Right, at parody.
Therefore, yeah, exactly.
Claim it's a parody.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I didn't, for some reason, want to mess with that particular organization. So, that perhaps humorless legal organization. So,
was there an actual budget for the book just devoted towards
I did not actually end up...
No,
the budget's mine. It's my money. So.
Yeah.
And it turns out I didn't. I used everything short enough that I don't require permissions under what we are desperately hoping will be construed as fair use.
You would think 16 words would be fair use.
Apparently 15 is fair use. 16, we'd like all your money.
Yeah.
So, and take the joke off. So that was one concern in later drafts. Early on it was if I thought of something that I love and that I wanted to include, I would. And if in her case I wanted her to have her own song, so I wrote her lyrics. They were relevant to the story. Sometimes I couldn't think of a song that would fulfill exactly what I wanted it to do, so I made up a title. And a lot of it's just fun. Like, the original list of bands that are playing at the bar,
yeah.
which is posted on a schedule over the urinal in the bathroom, was, like, probably four times as long, and all of my friends and family said, you've got to stop compulsively making new band joke names. So I had to cut that down.
But that's also a theme of yours. You often have lists of imagery or lists of bands or lists... I mean, I'd say that probably once every, like, 25 pages, you can count on, Arthur Phillips is going to throw us another one of these lists of, like, you know, strings of words plus commas and all that. Why the lists obsession here?
Makes me happy. I probably learned that you could do it from Georges Perec, who I worship. And I saw him do it and thought, wow, you can do that? Fun. You know, I mean, my heart is generally with the writers who made me realize, wow, you can do that? That looks like fun.
Yeah.
So that's probably where it comes from.
But that can't be the only reason to
I can't.
You come up with things yourself,
I can't live just for fun. But, I mean, if it helps build the house at the same time, and one wall of the house happens to be papered with, you know, rock posters, then so be it. You're likely to come up with something that maybe you haven't read somewhere before.
Well, Arthur, thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
This is great.
All right, thanks for your time. Thank you. When you've gone upstairs, I'll creep and ride it on down, 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 oh, Shelley, oh, Deborah, oh, Julie, oh, Jane. So many songs about you, I forget your name, I forget your name. Jennifer, Allison, Philippa Sue, Deborah, Annabelle Sue, I forget your name. Jennifer, Allison, Philippa.
puzzle.